Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Masa al khair, everyone. Welcome. Good evening. Hello. So it's my great pleasure this evening. This is an event we've been long awaiting, long looking forward to. My name is Maurice Pomerantz. I'm the senior director of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. And I just wanted to tell you, as you know, this is our 15th anniversary season. We have a slogan, which is explore, share, and grow. So I'm hoping that you'll join us for a wide range of talks that we have coming up in February. Is a very, very busy month here at the Institute. I just wanted to alert you that on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, the 7th at 6:30, we have a talk entitled Harmonizing Hope, and it's the resilient journey of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music will be the topic. Something very different, but also a talk that I really hope that all of you come out to see, because it's a really interesting and quite, I think, important story. But today, it's my pleasure to introduce on the first, my dean, Awam Ampa, who's the dean of arts and humanities here at NYU Abu Dhabi, who will introduce this lecture series, which is part of our Global Crossroads series. So please, Dean Ampa.
Thank you. Good evening and welcome everyone to NYU Abu Dhabi, to of course the Institute and its amazing programming and the collaboration with my colleagues in arts and humanities under the Global Crossroads rubric. We're so delighted to have you here. I also want to acknowledge the presence of our provost, Ali Peters, who is also a writer. So Ali's not only here as a provost, but as a curious writer who's happy to be here to share with you our encounter this evening with our guest, Shihan Karuna Thilaka. Before I do that, I also want to acknowledge my colleagues in the Institute for always putting up an amazing show and collaborating with every aspect of the university, and of course my colleague Maurice for making this, bringing this to where it is. But shout out to my colleague Hashana Rampakwela, who is a visiting professor of literature and creative writing in our division, who made this possible way back, even before we, most of us, got to know about Shihan. He had started introducing and talking about Shihan. and I believe when you even proposed one of the books that just was about to win a prize, and just about, yeah. So thank you for giving us that opportunity. So our guest, Shihan Karuna Thilaka, won the Booker Prize in 2022, considered one of Sri Lanka's foremost authors. But apart from writing in the fictional world of novels, he's also written rock songs, screenplays, travel stories, and Shihan actually first came to a global attention when in 2011 he won the Commonwealth Book Prize, and then the DSL, the Gratian Prize for his debut novel, Chinaman. The book was declared the second best cricket book of all time by Wisden. Now, For those of us who know what cricket is, it's really quite a thrill. I know some of my cousins in America talk baseball, but for those of us from the colonies, it's a big deal. And of course, there was a canonical works by various folks, including C.L.R. James, on cricket. So it's a really analytic, apart from a subject of stories. Sheehan was born in Galle in Sri Lanka in 1975. He grew up in Colombo, studied in New Zealand, and he has lived and worked in various global cities like London, Amsterdam, and Singapore. He currently lives in Sri Lanka, and we had the drama of bringing you here with the plane cancellation and so on. But his songs, scripts, and stories have been published by Rolling Stone, in GQ, the National Geographic, and others. He has worked as an advertising copywriter and played the guitar in a band called Independent Square. His second novel, The Seven Moons of Mahali Almeida, was announced as the winner of the Booker Prize 2022 on October 17th at a ceremony in London. So really, we're looking forward to the conversation, and thank you for the opportunity of interacting with our faculty, students, and staff. And welcome to NYU Abu Dhabi, welcome to Arts and Humanities and the Institute. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for making it to the event. Thank you, Awam, for that very generous introduction, and Ali, it's wonderful to see you here as well. I would be remiss if I also don't do a round of thanks, though the thanks was already done. First of all, the NYUAD Institute and its director, Professor Maurice Pomeranz, the assistant director, Nahed Ahmed, who's unfortunately not here, but did a huge amount of the background work that made this event possible. Then my colleague, Toral Gajrawala, who's not here, unfortunately. It was with Toral that I made this proposal initially. She's in New York now. And of course, the NYUAD team. It takes a village to organize something like this. So welcome, Shehan. And as Awam mentioned, you almost didn't make it, which is...
I would have walked here. I would have swum here. It's okay. Yeah.
Knowing you, that was quite possible. I think it's kind of interesting because your work is very surreal in many ways, and that surreality comes from the place we live as well. And I think the flight cancellation speaks to, in many ways, I'll return to that theme later in the evening, to how fiction is born out of kind of a particular ethos. But I think we'll start with a little bit of an introduction about who you are. So what was your childhood like? Tell us a little bit about your life in Sri Lanka and also this time that you spent in New Zealand, which I think also probably had a formative influence on you. And perhaps generally sort of say a little bit about how all of that factors into your literary craft as well.
Oh, so you want to go Freudian right at the beginning, is it? Okay. David Copperfield. I was born in Gaul, if we're going to start there. Gaul is a lovely place. We had a literary festival recently there in the south of Sri Lanka. I only spent my first 2 years there, but you know, formative years. I learned to read and write. I was potty trained there. Lifelong skills. But if you look at the pattern, I've spent 5, 6, 7 years in Sri Lanka, and then I get disgusted and disillusioned with the place, and then I want to flee, and then I think the places you outlined, I've lived in London and Singapore and studied in New Zealand, and then suddenly there's a story to write, and I always feel I have to come back, and that's certainly been the pattern throughout my life. So my childhood was in Sri Lanka, so up till age of 16, so if you look at most of the 80s, so 1982 to 1990, which is really the start of the whole mess. 1983 is the start of Sri Lanka's civil war, and 1988-89 is the period that I write about in The Seven Moons. And then family migrated to New Zealand, and that's where I did my studies and finished that off. And yeah, I started my career as a copywriter in Sri Lanka, lived in London a while, and then came back, and because I had a story to write about a cricketer and a drunkard, and I thought that's the place to write it, and then did that for 3 years. That was Chinaman, and then I moved to Singapore because it's not a lot of money in writing about cricketers and drunks, and I had to earn a living and live over there. But when I was in Singapore, suddenly the seeds of this story, a ghost story about Sri Lanka's past, kept bugging me, and I had to return. And look, I mean, you asked about what influence all this back and forth has. I suppose you got to leave that for the therapists or the biographers. I don't really know. But I think one thing is I've been able to write as an insider and as an outsider, and I guess that's something quite important to me, because I think growing up, reading about Sri Lanka, you always got outsider point of views, whether it was visitors coming in, talking about the mess that Sri Lanka was, or diasporic writers, so Sri Lankans who've lived abroad or grown up abroad, looking in. And I think one thing that I started writing, I guess, in the 90s, and I was always thinking, Michael Ondaatje, so now the great Sri Lankan writer, and we can talk about him a bit later, he mentions this in Anil's Ghost, the idea that stories of what was called the Third World, now it's called the Global South, I don't know what it's going to be called next, but stories about that are always, it's always a protagonist from the West flies. I mean, if you look at the Vietnam movies we grew up watching, Killing Fields, it's always a protagonist from the West comes into this dystopia, has an experience, and then is profoundly changed. But there's that scene with the helicopter, where the helicopter's flying away, there's this moving music, and he's waving down at his friend who's sitting down waving at the helicopter. And then he goes back to wherever, London or New York, writes his book, wins a Pulitzer. But I was always interested in, what about that poor guy on the ground waving at the helicopter? There's no Pulitzer for him. He's got to go back to his dystopia and live. And so I guess that's what motivated me in starting to write. I thought, let's talk of Sri Lanka from the point of view of the person who has nowhere else to go and is forced to live in this and forced to make sense of life in this crazy, messed up place. And so I guess that's where the influences come from. So, but I have been in Sri Lanka now 10 years because I made the fatal mistake for a novelist. I got married and had children. And so I've been there for 10 years. My children are now 9 and 7, so they're a lot more manageable. They understand when the doors close, but at one point they were 2 and 4, so that's why this book took 7 years to write. But yeah, I've been there for 10 years now, so maybe it's time to move somewhere else. Who knows, maybe Abu Dhabi, who knows? Yeah, let's see. Let's see.
I think you gave like a perfect answer in a way. It's such a rich answer to what was a biographical question. And I think that shuttling imaginary that you talked about is so important in a way, because we do have very good stories, but it is also important to experience the outside in a way and to be away from that culture in order to have a certain kind of reflection towards it. And you also talked about, and I think this is what is very unique about you, because you're the first Sri Lankan writer to win a major global literary prize who is actually based in Sri Lanka. So we've had Michael Ondaatje, we've had Ramesh Gunasekar, Shyam Selvadurai, many others who have made their mark on Anglophone fiction internationally, but they are expat writers in many senses. And the kind of thing that you were talking about, people looking from outside in, is present in that kind of writing. And that's what I don't see in your writing. And I think that's what resonates deeply with a lot of Sri Lankans. There's something very Sri Lankan about it, very intangible. And we'll come to that as well, the humor, the way you play with words, the kind of the rhythm that you capture. And it's very Sri Lankan in a way. And I think that can only come from a person who has had a very substantial experience living there. So to go back to something that you mentioned about being a professional writer, that you worked in advertising, how much of that helped you as a professional writer? What kind of discipline did that bring? Because we also have people who are interested, deeply interested in writing here in the audience, for them as well. Because, I mean, I've been part of a number of literary juries, etc. And one of the things that you're frustrated is with, you get these brilliant ideas, but they're not crafted, they're not edited, they're just unfinished products. So does the, does that vocation of yours factor into your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still dabbling in advertising. I mean, up till October last year, I was a copywriter who wrote novels on the side. I think you get disillusioned with that profession and you lose your stomach for it. But, you know, I owe a lot to it. I drifted into it because I did an English degree. My dad wanted me to do economics and accounting and finance. And I did that for the first year. And then I slowly started adding history papers and sociology, and I changed my major. I didn't tell him until graduation. He didn't find out till then. He was going, art of the film, European art and architecture, is this finance or economics? And he kept asking me this question, what the hell are you going to do with the English degree?
And in Sri Lanka, you have to be a doctor or an engineer or an accountant.
Well, I think that was his generation. My dad was a doctor, but yeah. I think he said, no, I'll give you a choice. You can either be economist or accountant. There you go. And my children now, they're quite creative. They all draw and they write stories. But yeah, I want them to be investment banker or oil oligarch. I told them that. I'll give you a choice. But I remember, so I drifted, because I didn't have an answer. I was, in my early 20s, I didn't think I'd be a role model to teach. I didn't think I had the discipline to do journalism, which is actually proper work. But advertising, it was a career that was, I didn't have to shave. I could grow my hair long and go to work in T-shirts. But I think what happened with advertising and what I really appreciate is, you have to be creative every day. You can't wait for inspiration to strike. If the client's coming on Thursday and it's Wednesday afternoon and you don't have anything, you better come up with something before the client turns up. And so, therefore, whether you feel it or... therefore, you come up with ways to be creative, to ideate, to brainstorm. And I think same thing with writing long novels as well. It's a job. You turn up on Monday, and I work 6 days a week. I work at 4 a.m, again, because of the kids. They're asleep at 4 a.m. And you turn up every day, and most days are pretty tough. Most days, there's nothing to write. You sit there staring at this paper and end up, going on YouTube and playing with the guitars in your room. But I turn up every day. And then by Thursday, Friday, maybe a paragraph emerges. And so I think that's what I really got from advertising, is that you have to be creative on command, and you have to have techniques for that, and you can't wait for inspiration. And I'm writing a third novel at the moment. I'm writing a children's book about insects, and I started doing that. We'll go into the craft of and the technique and all of that, but... yeah, but I started it in December, and I remember for 3-4 weeks nothing was happening. And you go, even after a Booker Prize, you think, what am I doing? Am I going to get found out? Do I have any talent? Am I any good at this? I get stressed writing an email. That's why I don't reply to your text till about 4 weeks later. I'm trying to craft the perfect answer for Harshana. And
thank you for telling me.
Yeah, it's nothing personal. So writing has always been hard, but then you. You force yourself to not get up from the chair. And sometimes you just write, even if the words are coming out all mangled, you write. So I think that's what I really appreciate from advertising, that it gives you that discipline and gives you that persistence. And, sometimes the book really flows. Sometimes, with Chinaman, you have moments where the characters start talking to you and telling you the story. But that doesn't happen. That happens maybe once or twice a year. Most of the time, you're grinding it out. So... I think the main achievement for me was getting my dad off my back. By the time I turned 30, I said, well, this is a viable career, even though I'm not wearing a tie or getting a haircut. So I think, I still do it, and I'm still interested in it.
Yeah, and I think if my memory serves correctly, even Salman Rushdie came from an advertising background. I think he was a copywriter at some point in his life.
Yeah, there's been Joseph Heller, Faye Weldon.
Right.
It is a well-trodden path. But also, on the flip side, every advertising copywriter, every art director you meet says, I'm just in this for, I've got a screenplay that I'm going to do. I've got a photo exhibition. So it's a bit of a cliche. So one thing I didn't tell anyone that I was writing a novel when I was working in advertising. I'd go to meetings, but I'd be keeping notes and all of that. But yeah, it is a legitimate part. Because the reality is, I think 90% of writers, they don't all get to be J.K. Rowling or Stephen King. That's like 0.1%. Most of us are jobbing writers where we're teaching or we're writing features and we're doing this on the side. And I think that's a pact you make with yourself. And that's something that came to me during COVID. COVID was when I really felt like a writer. And before all these prizes, I thought, because suddenly all the clients moved online. And I know now everyone works in their pajamas, but we did it before it was cool. We used to sit there I think I made the decision in COVID was that I can sustain this life. I can do my freelance for 2, 3, 4 days a week and write for the rest of the time. And it doesn't matter if no one reads my book, I'm gonna keep writing. And I think most writers have that persistence, that compulsion. It may be a mental disorder even. I think that's what separates writers from civilians. Most people write and it's awful and they think, I better do something better with my time. But a writer will write and it's awful and you'll come back to it. And that was certainly the case with Seven Moons. It went through 3 or 4, writing 300 pages and then throwing them in the bin knowing they're all crap. That's a heart-wrenching moment. Because it takes just as long to write a crap book as it does to write a decent book. That's the sad thing. But I'd given it up and I thought, okay, I'm going to stop writing, I'm going to do something else. But then you come back to it. And I remember from the wreckage of one of my drafts called Devil Dance, which I believe I shared with you. Yes. I'm sorry about that. It was incomprehensible. But there was nothing. It was 300 pages of lots of ideas and characters and a garbled mess, but within that wreckage, there was this character of this dead war photographer called Mali Almeida. And then I came back 2 years later and thought, okay, forget everything else. I'm going to write a story about this Mali Almeida. Who is he? How did he die? Why did he die? And that's where it came out from.
Yeah, and I think what you also speak to is the mental resilience that is required of a writer. Because as you say, it's heartbreaking to work on something so passionately and then having to sometimes it'll be rejected, multiple rejections with publishers, literary prizes, etc. So kind of shifting track a little bit to sort of literary ecologies or how writers are made in a way. So there is a very interesting story to how you are here today, I think, in a way, the journey of you as a writer. And I'm also kind of connected to that tangentially through what is called the Gratian Trust. Shehan mentioned the Canadian writer Michael Ondaatje. Michael Ondaatje was born in Sri Lanka and migrated to Canada when he was in his teenage years. He's a globally known writer. He won the Booker Prize in 1993. And with the prize money, he created an endowment called the Gratian Prize in honor of his mother. His mother was Gratian Doris. So that was in 1993, or 30 years ago. And Shehan won the Gratian Prize in 2009 for a manuscript of Chinaman, which went on to win the Commonwealth Prize. And in a way, the existence of that prize in Sri Lanka has, because Sri Lanka doesn't have a large English language literary market. It's a small country anyway. And within that country, the English readership is really limited. So to speak about literary prizes, etc. Prizes are always very controversial. People are unhappy. There's always criticism about the final outcome and all of that. And I think it also kind of relates to the place we are in because we have a very strong literature and creative writing program here at NYU Abu Dhabi. And I think we are moving on to bigger things as well soon. And also Abu Dhabi itself is positioning itself through sort of the culture industry and all of that. So like investing in that and then having that kind of ecology around. So, you might have 100 failures, but then you have that one, success story. And it takes that entire you know, ecology to support that. So if you want to say a little bit about literary prizes and how they help literature.
So prizes, I mean, I had this opinion of prizes when I started writing, and I haven't changed it despite winning a few, is that the truth is, and this is true of Bookers and Pulitzers and Oscars and Grammys, pretty much prizes are bullshit until you win one. until you win one, then everything else is, because, I mean, we just had the Grammys and, you know, you can have many examples. I don't think Hitchcock won an Oscar for Best Director. The Beatles won one Grammy, but Post Malone's won 17, and nothing wrong with Post Malone, but, and also with the Bookers, the Pulitzers. I mean, I followed the prizes, and often there'll be a book in the long list which I think, wow, that's the book, and it never makes it past, and then something wins. And so, yeah, this is a subjective in precise science and all of that. But, you know, the benefits are undeniable, and I come from advertising. That's the industry that gives itself so many prizes, and again, they're kind of meaningless things, but except for the guys who win them. The guys who win them talk a lot about it. But look, I can't diss prizes too much because you're absolutely right. I clearly benefited from it because I think you can track Sri Lankan writing from, I think it was 1992, right? Tondachi won for The English Patient. You can track Sri Lankan writing from the inception of the Gratian Prize, before and after the Gratian Prize, because, so he set up the Gratian Trust in, what, 92, 93, and the first book to win was The Jamfruit Tree by Karl Muller. And you know, Karl Muller's not remembered or maybe not as widely known as the Ramesh Gunasekaras, the Selvadurais, and Ondaatjis. But for me, he was the guy who really opened the doors because I think growing up in the 80s, you go to a bookshop in Sri Lanka. Like now you go to a bookshop, there's a Sri Lankan section, there's a South Asian section. Back then, I remember you had all the blockbusters, the Jeffrey Archers, the Sidney Sheldons, Jackie Collins, Stephen Kings. And then you had the Sri Lankan books, which were on a bottom shelf, and you could see they were sort of self-published, they didn't look that impressive. And you know, there were a lot of solid writers, Punyakanti, Vijayanayak, Martin Vikramasinghe. But I'd read these things, and they were sort of celebrating the village, the kind of this idyllic version of the village. And you know, I was a Colombo kid growing up watching MTV, and it was a bit hard for me to relate to these things. And a lot of the writings, lesser well known, you got a feeling Sri Lankans were trying to write like Englishmen who lived 100 years ago, almost to show that, you know, I can write as well as E.M. Forster or Graham Greene or Hemingway. And Karl Muller changed that for me because, and also I think, you know, luck comes into everything in life, but certainly with prizes. But I can't consider myself lucky to have been a young writer in the 90s because, okay, we had Ondaatje who had won the highest prize, Ramesh Gunasekara who was celebrated, and Shyam Selvadurai, funny boy, quite groundbreaking. I mean, now you have a lot of LGBTQ content, but to write a coming-of-age gay novel in 95 was quite groundbreaking. But Karl Muller, he wrote about the burgher community. So the burgher community are the descendants of the Dutch, the Portuguese, the English. Probably the only minority in Sri Lanka not to have a separatist movement, I guess. You know, and then they're stereotyped as sort of eating, drinking people. You know, happy-go-lucky, you know, it's a stereotype. But Karl Muller wrote about the von Bloss family, and this family of hard drinking, partying, this burgher family who were getting into fights, you know, sleeping with each other's spouses. But the most important thing was it was written in a very Sri Lankan voice. It was written like a drunken uncle telling you a story. And that really inspired me because I thought, you know, I can't write as elegantly as Ondaatje or Gunasekara, but I can certainly write like a drunken uncle, or I can try doing that. And I think, and also, you know, a lot of things were happening in South Asian literature. I mean, a decade earlier, Midnight's Children opened the doors for a lot of South Asian writers because Salman Rushdie does not sound like Salim Sinai. Salman Rushdie is actually a posh Englishman, but he, through artistry and craft, channeled the voice of the Mumbai of his childhood, Bollywood, and wrote. And it dawned on me that, you know, South Asia, because growing up, I thought, why can't a Sri Lankan book be up there next to the Stephen King's? And I think a lot of us tried to write like what you know, the West was writing. But I think, and then later, Rohitan Mistry, Arundhati Roy, and then we had the golden age of Pakistani writing with Mohsin and Hanif and Kamila and H.M. Naqvi. And it told me that one thing, South Asia has a lot of absurd, tragic, comic, bizarre stories. But also, we can tell them in our way, in our language, in our way of speaking. We don't have to sound like an Englishman. We can actually sound like ourselves. And so really, that was... the Gratian Prize happened, Muller won that. And I spent the 90s and the 2000s submit, because the Gratian Prize has the sexiest deadline. December 31st is the deadline. Like the Pulitzer some in July, some awkward date, the Booker something in August. But this is 31st December, right when you're thinking of, you know, giving up smoking and losing some weight and, you know, being a nicer person, you think, okay, have I written anything worth submitting for the Gratian? And I did that. And so it got me writing. And I know I'm not the only one, because every year now, there's about seven... I mean, how many entries do you get? About 70 or 80?
70, 80. Yeah.
You get, so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure not all of them are masterpieces, but it got people writing. And I submitted, you know, in my 20s. And I don't think I even got a long list, but I kept writing. And then finally, when I stumbled on this idea of this left-arm spinner who was a genius cricketer who disappeared in the 80s, I started writing that. And that happened to win the Gratian Prize. And that's where everything, that was the, I guess, the start of the whole thing. And since then, I mean, that was 2010. And... finished that, took a job in Singapore, and because when you're writing in Colombo, you're not expecting to be published. You're not thinking about Booker Prizes or anything like that. You're just thinking, you know, can I tell this story properly? Maybe the Indians might like it. Maybe someone in the region might like it. The prizes, at least I think one thing, you know, I know I diss prizes, but one thing it does do, it gives you a lovingly curated list of books to. As a benchmark. And so I read as many of the Booker, the Pulitzer stuff, and, you know, likewise, you know, the Oscar nominations out, and you watch those movies. And so I guess, you know, you internalize what writing appeals to you and what doesn't. So I think that's where prizes come in. But yeah, 10 years later, everyone was asking, what's your second trick? You know, what's your next trick? What's your next book going to be about? And... I mean, we can talk about the whole publishing history of that. There was a time where it didn't look like it was going to be published outside of India. And then suddenly got a Booker long list in the height of Sri Lanka's collapse. And then it got a short list. And I thought, okay, it means that the book's going to be reviewed. And then it won the damn prize. And then that's why I'm here. And now I guess I'm a legit writer. I'm not a copywriter who dabbles in novels. I'm an actual proper writer. So, yeah, you have to acknowledge the role of luck in your life and all of that, and acknowledge that prizes do give you benchmarks. But I think writing for prizes, writing with the expectation of prizes, that's a sure recipe for heartache and depression and drinking gin at 10 in the morning. You know, so you write because you have this story that you think only you can tell, and that's really the motivation for me. And I think for a lot of South Asian writers, you think, someone should tell this story, probably no one will, and maybe I'm going to have a crack at it. So I think that's how prizes really motivated me. But yeah, I certainly owe a lot to them.
Yeah, I think you said a couple of very interesting things. One is about the kind of the stories that come out of South Asia and the rhythm they carry into the English language and into English writing. And I don't think I'd be wrong to say perhaps over the last almost 20 years, the English novel, in a way, has been sustained by stories from the so-called Global South. There's such a lot of vibrancy of the stuff that has come out. And another thing that you mentioned about what Michael said, so in his first speech in 1993, he says, when you see yourself in an international publication, in a book, your sense of self is doubled. So your ambition to, you know, why can't we win this? Why can't we put ourselves out there? And I think that's just wonderful. That really speaks to, I think, Michael's vision as well. So I do have many more interesting questions, but let me pause now and let's do one of the readings from, so that our audience gets to hear a flavor of your, or do you want to?
Yeah, sure, I can do a reading. Yeah. Shall I read from the Seven Moons, I suppose? I brought all my books here. You know, product placement, I'm advertising guy. These are my kids' books, by the way, Sneaky Plants. This is my masterpiece, really. Where Shall I Poop? Where Shall I Poop? This is potty training book. It's doesn't get the attention it deserves. Didn't win any prizes. But I'll read from the one that everyone knows. Go to the podium, is it? Yeah.
You can do it from here. So
this reading, I know, so Seven Moons, for those who, it's a lot of things, but I would say it's a story about a dead guy who has 7 days to find out who killed him. That's one sentence sales pitch. And it's got demons and talking animals and hungry ghosts and all of that. But I'm going to read you a part which doesn't have any of them. It's got actually a far more terrifying creature, the corrupt policeman. And so this is a bit where the two policemen are deciding what to do with the body of Mali Almeida. The neighborhood was called Kompanya Vidya by the Sinhalese and Komanu Theru by the Tamils, both meaning company street. The British called it Slave Island. These names persist today and provide rather unsubtle clues to how natives and colonizers viewed one another. The back of Hotel Leo is an abandoned lot that serves as a rubbish dump for the neighborhood. The surrounding streets are crumbling buildings and slums. The crenellated rooftops are occupied by worried cats and bored bats. Body was here? Detective Kasim points to the dent in the garbage bags with the splatters in red. Kottu and Balal nod. You thought this was a drop-off? Sir, this building is a drop-off point, says Kottu. You didn't think there was too much blood? Sir, didn't think like that. Kasim shines a torch up the walls of the hotel. It looked like red and brown paint had been thrown down its side. You didn't notice those stains? Sir, when collecting garbage, no time to look at scenery. Keep talking like that and see what happens, snaps ASP Ranchaguda. From today, you will give full paperwork. Balal and Kottu are silent. Detective Kasim shines his torch around the rest of the rubbish dump. The night has been one of bad smells. A breeze whizzes past him and makes him shiver. Detective Kasim turns to Kottu. He was thrown from one of these balconies. Not by us, right? Balal nods. Kottu coughs and looks away. So where's the rest of the body? Kottu looks at Balal, who looks at his feet. It's gone, sir. So I'm supposed to give his mother some limbs, a shoulder, and I don't know what that is. How do we prove that it's Mali Almeida? Ranchaguda speaks up. If he was taken in before, his fingerprints will be on file. Detective Kasim shakes his head. I trust our fingerprint department less than I trust you. Where's his head? Sir, we threw it in the lake. I don't want to hear it. Get me the head. I don't care if you have to drain the whole stinking Beira Lake. We need it tonight. Kottu picks up the phone in the office and gets driver Malli out of bed. Detective Kasim lumbers towards the lift. What are we doing, detective? Asks ASP Ranchaguda. Once they are out of earshot. You better put in for overtime, Puta. Ranchaguda pauses by the lift, but does not go in. Kasim gets inside and holds it with his finger. What's the issue? Boss, first you say you are transferring away from corpses. Now you want to put in for overtime? We have our job to do. What's our job? We protect the innocent, says Detective Kasim. I thought we protect the powerful. Do we need to discuss this now? Kasim takes his finger off the button, which causes the doors to close. He curses and sticks his arm out to block the lift's jaws.
Boss, I'm confused about another thing. Get in the lift now. Are we investigating this, or are we covering this up? Thank you.
Thank you, Shahan. Incidentally, one of the monikers, Kottu, is actually a street food in Sri Lanka. And you can get it here in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, you can get a good Kottu in Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, on Hamdan Street. So, building on that excerpt that you read, I think one of the most striking qualities about your writing is this sort of black humor and the satire that you use so effectively. And you have, I think, in many places acknowledge the influence of Kurt Vonnegut on your writing and how much you have sort of been inspired by Vonnegut's writing. So I think we really sort of don't focus enough on the role of humor in sustaining life in a way, because during Sri Lanka's Aragalaya, so this spectacular economic meltdown, if you went on social media in Sri Lanka, the number of memes and the creativity that just exploded. I mean, even I was standing in queues to get a gas cylinder for the house overnight sometimes. And in the midst of all of this strife, what in a way kept us going was this sort of, you know, never say die attitude and this humor. And I think you capture that absolutely brilliantly. But what I also want to ask is, like, we see this sort of surreal humor in, say, Marquez, in Borges, and other places which have kind of roughly similar histories. But you also bring a very Sri Lankan element to this, and you marked Karl Muller, who incidentally worked in the Khalij Times here in the Middle East, so before returning to Sri Lanka. So just talk us through the importance of humor and this kind of comic vision that you bring to more sort of extreme strife to,
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a question like you write, because, you know, no doubt it's a grim history, and you're talking about guys doing this gruesome act of disposing of bodies in the middle of the night. And it's not like I write it seriously and then I add the jokes in later. I think it's the type of narrator that you're attracted to. And I also think, like, a book does not exist until you have a voice. You can have a plot, you can have ideas, you can have characters, maybe you know where it's going, maybe you have themes that you want to express. But until you have a voice of a piece, it doesn't exist, even if you're writing a short story or a kid's book. And I think both of the characters that, say, in Chinaman, I mean, Chinaman is a guy drinking himself to death. He's got one, page one, he's told he's got 1 year to live, and he decides to do a cricket documentary. And it's a grim story about this guy and his fractured relationships, but he sees the humor, or the absurdity, I would say, the comic absurdity in his life, in Sri Lankan cricket, in the way it's played, and also in the wider context of Sri Lanka. And you're right, even in Sri Lanka's darkest moments, the jokes never stop. The Aragalaya is a great example. Those petrol queues, like, when I got the news that I was longlisted for the Booker, my wife was in a 4-day petrol queue. It snakes around the shed, and you've got to sit in your car all day, and then at night you get out and you come back at 5 and you sit back in there. And I had to bring her food and beer, and she was, and meanwhile I had to take care of the kids. And at the end of that week, I remember she got a full tank of petrol, and I got a Booker long list, and a friend came over and was like, "Hey, congratulations, full tank of petrol, well done. Oh, by the way, well done on this Booker thing." And he was only half joking. But those petrol queues, yeah, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of frustration, but there were people who were playing cards, people who were cracking jokes. And I think maybe this is a defense mechanism, maybe it's the Sri... You know, I've written about the Sri Lankan smile. So I worked in advertising, writing tourist brochures, writing ads for Sri Lankan Airlines, the airline that, you know, canceled their flights yesterday. And we talk about this warm Sri Lankan smile, how we're such warm, hospitable, genuine people, which is true most of the time. But also, I'm very suspicious of the Sri Lankan smile, because when Sri Lankans are angry or afraid or confused, when the waiter messes up your order, they smile. Like yesterday, when that that lady was telling me that the flight's been canceled, she was grinning ear to ear. And sometimes we use the smile because as a mask. And I think we use humor the same way. And I guess we know that if we don't crack jokes, we're gonna crack skulls or punch each other, and it's better to laugh at each other, poke fun at each other, than start punching each other. So I think that's part of the Sri Lanka, and maybe not just Sri Lanka, I think it's, you see that in the rest of South Asia and rest of Asia as well, this gallows humor that, because we accept that we all live in different dystopias. I mean, I think that's why my books have, you know, they're well received in Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, India. I mean, before the book of Chinaman, that's where it sold the most. And even though we've had very different histories, we all relate to the fact that we live in different dystopias with different bumbling leaders. And we feel powerless against it. There's not much as a citizen we can do about it. So we make jokes. And I think that's definitely the case of Mali Almeida. He's dead on page one, and he's watching his body being chopped up and chucked in a lake. But he still can make sarcastic comments. But also, just practically, I was trying to, because it's hard to research how to dispose of a body, right? I tried Googling it. Don't Google that. You get some very strange answers. But I realized, okay, this is a practical problem, because, you know, in a much more sober note, so many Sri Lankans went missing during that period, to this day. Disappeared, abducted, parents still holding up their photographs, wondering what became of them. And we haven't found the bodies, so either the country is full of these mass graves that haven't, and a few have been uncovered. Where are the bodies? So I tried to imagine a typical Sri Lankan bureaucracy. It would have been, so Balal and Kottu are two criminals who can't get jobs elsewhere, and they have this dirty job that no one wants to do of disposing of bodies. And I just tried to imagine that scene, and I realized if it's a bunch of Sri Lankans trying to do a job, there'll be jokes there. They'll be cracking jokes, and one of them wants to be very professional and do it. The other one kind of feels a bit grossed out, but realizes he's got to feed his family, and they kind of make fun of each other. So, but also maybe from a writing point of view, it makes it easier to write about, because if I told a sober account of what happened over that terrible period, might be difficult for me to write and difficult for someone to read. So you temper it with these absurdist, sarcastic cracks by the characters. But of course, there does come a point where the jokes have to stop. Like, the book does go into places like torture chambers, and that's where, yeah, it. So you have to, it's a fine line. You can't be seen as making fun of these things. But I think humor is definitely part of the Sri Lankan sensibility.
Yeah, and I think the way I read it is, in a way, your fiction particularly is this comedy makes an unintelligible world intelligible, in a way. There's no other way, in a way, to write about the surrealness of some of the things, the impunity, the culture's complete lack of justice, etc., which we have lived with for decades. I think our generation has grown up with almost roughly decades of cycles of violence, bloodshed, and nobody has been held accountable, and many, many of those people perhaps do still live in our society and thrive.
And the ghost story is also where these stories are kept alive, because the official, you know, the officials deny these things happened. We're not taught this history in schools. We're taught about our ancient kings, our colonizers. We're not taught about the last 40 years, and it's through, yeah, not so much memes and jokes, but certainly through ghost. I investigate a lot of ghost stories, and each ghost story was linked to a tragedy. So every ghost in Seven Moons is based on a real character. And it's interesting you bring about surrealism, because I think that's another tool. It's no coincidence that China has a very vibrant science fiction, speculative fiction, fantasy tradition. Not just, I mean, there's great Chinese writers, expat writers, Ted Chiang and Ken Liu, but also writers operating within the system. And, you know, it's not hard to guess why. Same reason why Marquez and Borges and Bolaño, because if you wrote a realistic critique of Chinese society or Latin American juntas and you criticize society and politics, you know, you're going to land in trouble. So therefore, sticking a dragon in there or a time machine in there and using these fantastical elements allows you to sort of hide, smuggle your message in. So I think these are legit tools that us in the global South have to use, and I think they can be used quite effectively.
I mean, humor has always had that subversive role, right? I mean, in the king's court, it was the jester was the one person who could make fun and not risk his head. So it has always had that function. So I want to, we are also kind of sort of running on time. So we will end our conversation and allow some space for Q&A as well. We'll get to that point soon. Just to sort of, since we are sort of into that realm now, to ask you a little bit of a more tough question about the politics of representation. So in both your novels, you draw upon relatively recent Sri Lankan history, history which both of us have experienced and history that continues to haunt the country in many ways. So many of the people and the situations are recognizable, and some may still be alive, and other may still kind of continue to haunt the public imagination, particularly, you know, people who are accused of torture, impunity, etc. So this is a kind of a risky strategy for a writer because it inevitably invites comment, both positive and negative. And I have seen this particularly with Seven Moons, where some have admired how you depicted some historical figures, particularly sort of iconic human rights defenders, and some have been much more critical. I feel this is especially so given how many of these figures are deeply implicated in Sri Lanka's recent conflictual history. So my question to you is, you know, how do you deal with the ethics of that, you know, taking these stories and fictionalizing them? And then also, almost, I mean, you would know, it will invite some kind of criticism as well. So how do you process that? How do you deal with that?
I think that's why I've chosen to be a fiction writer and not a journalist. I think journalists get in a lot more trouble than you stick a demon and a dragon in your book and you're okay. But you write critical, you know, things that are critical of, say, the current regime or the last thing, and you can land in hot water. And I was much more worried about the first book because there were names of real cricketers. There's Tony Botham and there's, Hashan Mahanama, and all. And I thought I was being clever by mixing up names, except, you know, and I asked a lawyer, you know, are we going to get sued for this? And they said, well, you know, you're not being clever. You're actually pissing off two people by mixing up the names rather than one person. But they also said, hey, getting sued by a famous cricketer is really good for book sales. No one sued us so far. Obviously, this one was much more serious subject matter, but also it was a deliberate choice to set it in 1989 and not 2009. I mean, 2009 was really what inspired it, because 2009 was the end of our 30-year war. And we were all, you know, our generation, we never thought the war would end. It seemed like a perpetual conflict. We'd grown up with it all our lives. It seemed like a forever war. So when it ended, we all thought, okay, now the country is going to move forward, be unstoppable. But of course, there were many questions about how the war ended, how wars end, and wars end by many innocents and civilians dying. And I think I was getting quite upset, quite triggered, quite disgusted by the fact that we were squabbling in the post-war period. We weren't thinking, okay, let's now deal with these grievances, let's heal these wounds and move forward. We were just squabbling, saying, well, people might have died, but it was your fault. It was human shields. I mean, we are hearing all these things, human shields and all that today, but we were laying the blame. It wasn't us, it was these guys who caused. And I wanted to write about that, but I, you know, even now, talking about 2009 is a contentious thing in Sri Lanka. So that's why I went to 1989, because, which is arguably probably the darkest period, because I felt most of the antagonists and the protagonists are dead. Most of the people who could take offense are dead. And that's why I felt emboldened to talk about it. And also, I think that history is pretty well documented. I'm not making any outrageous claims here. This is well documented history, and we know what happened. And I do disguise the names a lot more, but there are certain names I leave in. But I think mainly it's the activists who got killed. So the three obvious ones are Richard de Souza, Dr. Rajini Thiranagama, and Daya Pathirana. So that's Mali Almeida Sena and Dr. Rani, who I think they are their own characters. One moving response to Seven Moons was Dr. Rajini Thiranagama, who was a moderate Tamil voice activist. She was murdered by the Tamil Tigers. And this is what happens in these wars. The moderate voices get silenced by the extremes. And her two young daughters, who were 7 or 8 or 8 or 10 when it happened, they read the book, and I was quite worried because of how they would accept it. But there was a very Namada Thiranagama wrote me a very beautiful letter saying, I don't believe in the afterlife, but I believe in the creative power of fiction, and it was such
a pleasure. And she published a version in The Guardian.
Yes, and she said it was such a pleasure to be able to see my mother, and I've never met Dr. Rajini, but she was just as bossy as she always was in your book as she was in the... And so I was more worried about that, the heroes, how I depict them, and that's why they're much more fictionalized in this. I mean, unless you know Sri Lankan history, you may not recognize some of the minor ghosts and the antagonists. So I was quite careful to, make sure the characters in the book were... Because Mali Almeida is nothing like Richard de Souza. He may have some superficial similarities, but... And that's also the product of writing a book over 7 years. The characters start talking to you and telling you who they are and where they're supposed to go. I was concerned about the ethical choices of doing this, but also I felt safer, and touch wood, it's been okay, because it was 1989, not that long ago. I mean, less than 40 years ago, but it seems like ancient history to us because we've been through so many catastrophes since then. And I think one of the gratifying things is now, up till last October, basically my fan base were middle-aged men who were into cricket, right? That was who'd come to my readings. But since the prize, my audience has widened, and I get a lot of young kids, kids who were born in the 90s, in the 2000s, and they come to me and they say, we knew that there was a war, but our parents don't talk about it, our teachers don't teach us about it. It was eye-opening to realize these things happen, and I keep telling them, don't come to my book if you want to find about the war. There are much better books written about it, or even just go on the internet, on Wikipedia, but learn about these things, because we tend to have this feeling, I think, in Asia, certainly in Southeast Asia, but certainly in Sri Lanka, this collective amnesia. It's this idea that, terrible things happen, but why talk about them? Why bring them up again? You're just asking for trouble. Let's just forget they happened and let's just move on, which is a privilege if you weren't affected. But if your house was burnt, if you lost one of your children, it's not so easy to do that. So I think maybe that's... Fiction writers are pretty useless most of the time, but maybe that's where we can contribute in that, keeping these stories alive and at least keeping these conversations alive. So, yeah, it is certainly a concern, whether you're writing about cricketers or terrorists, to how you mix fact and fiction and how you depict it and how you do it responsibly.
Now, I think you made a very important point about history and fiction, because I think that line is increasingly... thinner. It has got thinner. And it was, I think, Isabel Allende, who was a journalist, who had, I think, famously said at one point that at one point as a journalist, she felt that she was writing fiction. And therefore, she decided to abandon fiction and, abandon journalism and switch to fiction. These categories are not as clear-cut as we would like to think them to be, which is scary in a way, but it is also the truth. And just for the audience's information, 87, 89, there was a Maoist uprising in the south of the country. And at that point, the Indian peacekeeping force, which was an occupationary Indian army force, had arrived in the north of the country. So it was politically a very, very troubled period. And the government in power at that time created paramilitary forces, which operated outside the legal structures. And Disappearance was the name of the day. So if, you know, our parents are scared to let us out of the houses because, you know, if you are the wrong age, wrong profile, you just disappeared. And rivers literally ran red because they were famous dumping grounds. So that's the period that's mostly covered in this book. So shall we skip the second writing because we've kind of, you know, progressed in time and I think I need to open it out to the audience. Just before I do so, I just wanted to ask you, because we do have, as I said, aspiring writers, students from our creative writing program, as well as faculty who are interested in writing. So if there's any advice that you would give, this is a cheesy question, but to aspiring writers, what would that be? And also please share with us what your future projects are and what we can expect of you in the coming years. And then I'm sorry for putting you on the spot.
Well, so I'm doing a little thing tomorrow where we'll deep dive into the writing process and techniques.
I must thank Shahan, he volunteered to do this, which is not part of the deal that we got for him. So this is entirely him. So thank you very much for your generosity.
So we can get into that tomorrow, but short answer is I really can't better the advice given by Stephen King in his book on writing. And he said, if you want to be a writer, you have to read a lot, write a lot, and do it every single day. And really, that sounds simple and glib, but it's a tough thing to do. The toughest thing is allocating space and time in your life to do it. And I think even when I was working tough jobs where I was working till 10 in the night and weekends, I still would try and wake up early and, even 1 hour of reading, 1 hour of writing, and do it without fail every single day. And if you do that, even if you write a paragraph a day, by the end of a year, you'll have something. It may not be great, but you'll have something. And so I think that's the main thing that people have to overcome, aspiring writers, is committing to that and making that space. We'll go deep into it tomorrow. It's 7 steps to winning a Booker Prize, I think, is what I'm going to call it. And I'll give you all the tips and we'll have. You asked about my current project. It's second rule of writing club is we do not talk about what we write about, because that's another thing. You talk about what you're writing and it can go one. And I used to do this in my 20s. Usually to impress girls in bars, say, I'm a writer, this is what I'm writing. And you talk about what you're writing, either they say, wow, that's a brilliant idea, and you go home with a swollen head and you don't write. Or they say, well, I've kind of seen that before, it's kind of lame, and then you go home depressed and you don't write. And so just write the damn thing, rewrite the damn thing, and show it to people when they're ready. So I'll say I'm working on a third novel, a kid's book about insects. I can tell you the last one was about plants, and now I'm quite fascinated by insects. I'm convinced that they rule the earth and will be around when we are gone. I always have about 7 things on my to-do list. So there's an article, and usually what happens, you do the least urgent thing. Because if all you had to do is follow up Booker novel, you won't end up writing. So children's books. I'm doing some short stories. Got a screenplay idea. So there's plenty of projects to do, I'll tell you that there's no ghosts in the next novel. There's no cricket. There might be a few drunks, there's no corpses, and there's no politics. I want to write a nice, harmless little book which is going to keep me out of trouble.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.